You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. This week's From Embers, we're pleased to share an interview with Kevin Tucker. Kevin is a primal anarchist and anti-civilization author who recently published a book called The Cull of Personality, Ayahuasca, Colonialism, and the Death of a Healer. The book focuses on a story that many of you may remember from just last year, in which a Canadian ayahuasca tourist named Sebastian Woodruff shot and killed a Shipibo Conibo plant healer named Olivia Arevalo in the Peruvian Amazon, and then was himself lynched by members of her community. The story was big news across the country, and Kevin's book is coming out right around the one-year anniversary of Arevalo's death. My co-host reached Kevin by Skype to talk about the story, ayahuasca, colonialism, civilization, and New Age spirituality in the civilized world.
Yeah, my name is Kevin Tucker, and I'm a primal anarchist, anarcho-primitivist writer. I was the editor of Species Trader from 2000 to 2005, founded the Black and Green Network, Black and Green Press in 2000. Took part in Green Anarchy, the whole run. And I tend to be involved with a lot of projects, but my books are For Wildness and Anarchy came out in 2010, and the second revised and very expanded edition of that is hopefully going to be out this spring or summer. And then last year I put out a book called Gathered Remains. There's essays on wildness, domestication, community, and resistance. And then this year I put out a book called The Cull of Personality, Ayahuasca, Colonialism, and the Death of a Healer. I am the founding editor of a journal called Black and Green Review, which we just changed the name with the newest issue to Wild Resistance, a Journal of Primal Anarchy. And then I host the Primal Anarchy podcast.
Yeah, and I'm thinking before we get into the book, do you want to just frame some of those ideas, like some of your sort of touchstone ideas, like primal anarchy? Do you want to talk about what that means to you?
Yeah, so primal anarchy is something I've been increasingly pushing and kind of moving away from the term anarcho-primitivist. And for those who aren't familiar, anarcho-primitivism is a green anarchist anti-civilization critique of civilization that focuses on the reality of the fact that life with civilization has just continually made things worse. And it begins with this anarchist kind of understanding of where does power lie? How far back does it go? Is it just about the state? Is it just about government? And we just keep asking that question. And that seems to be the distinction between different branches of anarchism. And for us, it's indisputable by the time we get to civilization, which is defined by agriculture and the culture of cities. And then you can see the roots of it going back with domestication. So effectively what it comes down to and why I focus on the term primal anarchy is this is kind of a different contextualization even of human evolution and the way humans have evolved. And a lot of ways it's very in line with the work that Kropotkin had been doing in talking about mutual aid and understanding, you know, survival and evolution isn't just about who's out to get it for themselves, who's out to make it for themselves. We co-evolved, we work as mutual aid societies. And I think that effectively primal anarchy is the sum of the beginning of that argument. And I think his work as a naturalist was excellent. The problem was that Kropotkin just kind of kept going on and seeing aspects of that primal anarchy resurge throughout all these different hierarchical societies. And then it was just like, well, this could be it. This could work, and carried it on into thinking that industrialism could be egalitarian. And everything we've seen shows that it never was going to be. And I think that this kind of look at it of understanding that primal anarchy, this innate egalitarianism that defines how we've evolved for hundreds of thousands and millions of years as nomadic bands of hunter-gatherers, is really just indisputable. And this is how we relate with the world. And this is how we are all born. We're all born to be nomadic hunter-gatherers, and we're all conditioned consistently and constantly by domesticating processes in whatever form they're currently taking, be it, you know, an agrarian fiefdom or, our current modernity that's a globalized technological infrastructure. All these things follow the same sort of patterns. And at the heart of it, it's all about trying to tear apart and redirect our needs as social animals through hierarchical structures. So I do agree with a lot of what Kropotkin's done in seeing that this doesn't just die. It's not just gone in any society, but this is a part of us that is consistently fighting against domestication, fighting against civilization, usually not articulated in that way. But I think it's important to draw out that articulation to show it's like, you know, the idea of egalitarianism isn't just some idea that Europeans came up with in the last couple hundred years. This is our baseline. This is our reality. And so effectively, what it boils down to is talking about primal anarchy is saying it's like you were born a nomadic hunter-gatherer. The way that we see and interact with the world was meant for that life, and we are meant for that life, and our needs are built as social animals, and we've just been sold all these alternatives. And because our lives are so deprived of so much meaning, well, we buy into it and we take part in it, and in the end we end up fighting for it. But the reality of it is that egalitarian core is closer than it seems, and as the realities of civilization unfold, that's going to be something that just cannot be hammered home enough.
So The Call of Personality is the latest book that you've come out with. And it tells the story of, well, it really tells the story of the whole history and ongoing reality of brutal colonial violence, waged against native peoples of the Amazon, discussed through the lens of the murder of Olivia Arevalo and the subsequent lynching of the probable perpetrator, a Canadian ayahuasca tourist named Sebastian Woodruff. So I was wondering if you could start by basically telling the story of what happened to Olivia Arevalo, and as far as we know.
So there's a lot of stuff, and I know in Canada in particular, there's a lot of things and on the internet portraying the idea that Sebastian Woodruff couldn't have been the person who pulled the trigger, which by every other account and by all other reading and by all understanding about what had happened in that society, he definitely was. And the book is about contextualizing that murder. It's not necessarily about Woodruff, and it's not necessarily about Arevalo, but how this moment happened and how this moment occurred and how we got to this point in history. And it was impossible to tell anything about that murder without getting into it. And that is a deep history. And one of the aspects of the book that I think is important to point out is that history is something we treat as a past event. And so it makes it easy to look at these kind of things, and makes it easy even almost a year later. So it's April 7th now, it's April 19th, 2018 that this happened. So it was a very short time ago. You know, in the scheme of things and in the context of things, we're talking about two murders. And it's so easy in a historical perspective to just let that kind of fall behind. And the reality of it is that history is something that is constant. I mean, this living history, this constant cultural memory, this constantly reconstructed sense of belonging in the world and in a world that is changing and one that is often changing very violently and abruptly, all these things are going to constantly come to the surface if we're going to look at them, if we're going to understand them. And so much of the story that gets told really comes down to this single question, did Woodruff pull the trigger or not? And by all accounts, he did. So he had been going down to Peru for 5 years. He was somebody that I think a lot of us could probably relate to in a lot of ways. He was into foraging and he was into, you know, I mean, his whole idea was he had seen people around him succumb to addiction, and he wanted to try and improve that recovery process. And in that sphere, in that whole realm, there's a lot about ayahuasca and the primary chemical that can be pulled from it, which ayahuasca is the name of a vine. It's a cabi vine, but the actual ayahuasca is a brew. It's the DMT, which is the primary drug, and it is activated by another plant. So it can be a little confusing when you're talking about it sometimes, but that's what it is. It's not just the plant. It's this brew of two plants or one plant that's actuated by another one, and it causes all these hallucinogenic properties. So he's going down and he's following up on all this stuff that's saying that you could increase the effectiveness of these addiction recovery programs by introducing ayahuasca into it. And he had this Kickstarter campaign, and I kind of go back to the words throughout the book from his Kickstarter campaign that contextualize it all as saying there's this plant here and it's our right to, you know, it's our place to take it. There's a cultural memory here that can belong to the world, and it's important, and it's going to help with all these recovery programs, and just this singular kind of focus. So the reality of it is that there's a lot I don't know about Woodruff, and a lot that necessarily wasn't documented. He spent 5 years trying to do these programs and getting money to do this training, and indisputably he had been taking ayahuasca, and by a lot of accounts his personality had been shifting, because this is a very hefty plan to be taking. And by native accounts, such a healer such as Arevalo was somebody who was considered an Anyanya, which is a plant healer. And in more traditional versions of ayahuasca, which take on very traditional healing techniques within a lot of indigenous societies, which ayahuasca, as we come to know it, takes a very different form. It would be somebody like Arevalo taking ayahuasca and then guiding a person through the healing process. And it's an entire cosmology. It's an entire way of seeing the world that's involved in it. And to try and isolate it and pull it out was such a different thing. But for somebody like Woodruff, and as he comes to typify in his less than fascinating regards and the parts that make him so familiar to people like us, is this underlying principle of just pure entitlement and also just very limited vision, and being a white man from Canada, you know, the reality of being the supposed benefactor of civilization, the benefactor of colonialism. You're living and raised within the system that decimates the world, but it's built in a way that's meant to so that you never have to actually face the consequences of it. And then the reality of it is none of us are exempt from that. But the problem with systemic issues such as colonialism, such as every aspect of civilization, is that it gets harder to see them. So when somebody like Woodruff enters that world stage and enters into this platform and then enters into this moment in which he feels he's getting closer to understanding ayahuasca and he's getting closer to the point where he's going to take it back, his block is that he sees Arevalo as somebody who has like the last piece of this puzzle or a crucial piece of this puzzle, and he wants her songs. And so there's different variations of the story, whether or not she actually did curing or healing on him or whether she had given him songs. She did not give her blessing. And by most accounts, it would seem that she did not agree to any of it. And he shot and killed her. Her daughter was there. She died in her daughter's arms. He shot her twice. He had bought a gun from a police officer 2 weeks earlier. He went through her house. You know, there's a lot of accounts that try and make it seem like a lot of these aspects are obscured. And even in, especially Canadian media, it was posted saying like, oh, well, there was, you know, this really kind of primitive, shady flyer that was made, and that's what he was killed on, and it was unjust or whatever. The flyer spelled his name wrong, but it's pictures from his Facebook profiles. Like, there's, it's a color printout, you know. I mean, there's ways that it's like, you know, this otherization and this really kind of racist view that comes out constantly on behalf of the colonizers to say, it's like, well, indigenous people don't know what they're saying. They don't know what they're talking about. They couldn't have been right. They couldn't have known what was going on. They couldn't tell the difference between a white person. And this is a guy who'd been coming into this area for 5 years, or into Peru for 5 years. And they definitely were familiar with him. So, I mean, there's just in every regard, and it's not just in the history of how we get to that moment, but in just every regard about how that entire ordeal is looked at, it's impossible to overlook the sheer colonial privileges that we grant ourselves, or we presume on the behalf of Woodruff and not on behalf of Arevalo or on behalf of any of these indigenous rights activists and any of these people that have been subject to the realities of colonialism in ways that a Canadian or American man would never have to face.
And in the aftermath, after he killed Arevalo, he was lynched by some of her neighbors, correct?
Yeah, it was Shipibo Konobo people. And which, by the way, Arevalo was a huge proponent of Native rights. Like, she had been struggling for that. She was well known for it. These are people who had seen it. And there is video on the internet of that lynching. He was killed, I think it was a day or two afterwards. I don't recommend watching people videos of people die, but, you know, it doesn't change the reality of it. And, yeah, so he kills her and he is killed in response.
You know, one thing I appreciate about the book is that you don't want to, everything the Western media has done with this story, there was a real news frenzy after all this happened, and all the news coverage really centered around Sebastian Woodruff and his story, and sort of painting him as a sort of tragic hero victim type person. And in your book, you really try to tell the story of Arevalo's community and the history of colonial violence against that community, and situating this story in that sort of continuous circling of what you call imperialist frontier economics. Can you lay out a bit of what you're saying in terms of what is the general pattern and how this is an example of a continuation of that pattern?
The pattern that happens is basically coming in, just turning every single thing into a resource. And there's differences between areas of the United States and especially North America, and even a lot of parts of South America, where the idea was to call or to build colonies and have settlements and to fully colonize these areas. And then you have areas like the Amazon, which for the most part, it was always just going to be about extraction. And that was going to be in the form, as it still is to this day, gold, lead, zinc, iron ore, coal, phosphate, all of these things that feed the global economy were just, we're going to use the Amazon. We're going to tear it apart and use these people and enslave them. And we're just going to turn it into the global production unit for the globalized world. And this is particularly true for the Southern Hemisphere. When you see it in the Amazon, it is a difference. It wasn't just saying we're going to tear down the forest and we're going to build up all this, you know, civilization and it's going to be ours. The places where you do see cities and cities that have become important in the ayahuasca trade and global ecotourism, they were all because of the rubber boom. These were towns that were formed around the rubber boom, and they're along the Amazon River and all of its tributaries. And you see the same thing in the Congo. You see the same thing in a lot of different parts of the world, where it's just all these different avenues for capitalism's encroachment and civilization's encroachment into these regions where they were just going to extract. And because it was just going to be about extracting, there was never care. There was never a sense of like, we need this to keep going. We need to keep people alive. They're just going to kill people. And they were already importing African slaves to fill in the place of all the indigenous societies that have been murdered in the process as early as, I think, 1542 for Lima, Peru to be a major exporter of slaves. And it had already been exporting slaves, textiles, minerals, and metals back to back to Europe. But you have these just constant waves of colonization and market reintegration. As soon as somebody figures out how to use another thing from this area, how to extract another resource, you get these bounds. And so rubber reinvigorated that initial kind of contact and that initial bloodlust and just the absolute depravity that comes along with it. And we see some of the worst things in human history occurring again with a lot of real-time documentation. And then there was a British, he worked for the government, but it was a British guy who had gone in to investigate claims about the rubber trade in Europe, and that was Roger Casement. And he actually invented the term crimes against humanity based on what he had seen in the Amazon, which was also the same thing that he had seen happening in the Congo at the exact same time. And that was the rubber boom and just how sheer, the sheer insanity and the sheer brutality of it all. So that's going on. And then, you know, you can see these bubbles just constantly going. And even when you, every time you see a superfood, something like quinoa, which as soon as it blew up on the global market, natives of Peru and Incan people and Quechua people, it was a staple of their diet and they can no longer afford it. And you're seeing the same kind of patterns with ayahuasca, except because it's ayahuasca and it's thoroughly entrenched in this ecotourist kind of world, it gets to get this more smiley face. We're here for you. We're here to help you. We're here to put this on the global stage and to recognize your cultural ideas and your cultural beliefs and your cultural memories. And in reality, it's just like perpetuating these same cycles. And just because they look different and just because Woodruff had killed one person versus Pizarro having just decimated and having endemic impacts upon life in the Amazon, it doesn't mean that same core of entitlement isn't there. And they don't need to be the same. And it's the, and I say it in the book and I'll say it over and over again, it's the less fascinating, less fantastical elements of Woodruff's life and Woodruff's search that should be ringing true for us, because we have to understand this book is about primarily about ayahuasca. It's at its core. But the reality of it is, if you dig into any product that comes into our lives, and that especially is true for something like rubber, as I make, you know, I hope to make clear in the book and everything else, this is the kind of history that's there. This is the reality of what it takes to bring things to our lives and to have these things available when we go to the store in the middle of the night, or we're, you know, even have this conversation and we're talking over phones and computers in two different countries. Like, we don't have to face the consequences of colonialism and of civilization in our daily lives. And it makes it easier to obscure and historicize all the things it takes to get to these points and the wounding it takes and the impact it takes, particularly on indigenous societies, and the absolutely unfulfilled lives that we have as the recipients of all this, is an indictment of civilization. It's an indictment of colonialism and modernity and all this. And I think it's just, I can't overstate that point enough. The fact that we get to this point and the fact that we can do all these things and act with impunity and then look at somebody like Woodruff and say, well, he meant well, that's the story. That's always been the story. The entire history of colonialism and colonization, he meant well. And typically he. So I think that's, you know, there's a lot more to it. But at its core, I think that that's something I'm hoping to really convey.
You are listening to From Embers Anarchist Radio here on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast edition of From Embers on whatever device you use to catch podcasts. This week we're hearing an interview with Kevin Tucker, who is sharing his anti-colonial, anti-civilization analysis of the murders of plant healer Olivia Arevalo and Canadian ayahuasca tourist Sebastian Woodruff in the Peruvian Amazon last year.
Yeah, and you do, I think, make that point very well in sort of detailing how these different colonial archetypes, whether it's the conquistador or the industry baron or the missionary, are all sort of engaged in this mutually supportive process. And I just want to read from Sebastian Woodruff's crowdfunding page, because I think it does drive the point home pretty well. In his last paragraph on his crowdfunding page for his trip to Peru, he writes, "I cannot stress how important it can be to retain old knowledge, such as the knowledge these people have harbored in their cultural memory. It is a far more valuable resource than all the trees, minerals, and oil in the whole Amazon. Cultural knowledge cannot be restored once it is wiped out. It is something that takes tens of thousands of years to nurture. I feel responsible trying to support this culture and retain some of their treasure in me and my family, and share it with those that wish to learn. To expand on that idea, I feel this is my path of being a responsible, accountable human being."
I gotta be honest, like, this book was very f-ing hard to write. And it's hard for me to even, I wrote that, you know, it's in the book, and I use those words recur throughout the entirety of it. It kind of becomes the callback point for a lot of the things I'm discussing as they go along. People have harbored this cultural memory, and I mean, it's hard. You should be enraged by that. And it's the fact that, you know, even some of the discussions I've had afterwards and people trying to have these kind of counterpoints or whatever, it's one of those things where it's like, it might be slight, but the entitlement of it and just this religious kind of savior complex, it's just despicable. I still can't hear it. No matter how many times I've read those words, I can't hear it without getting pissed.
Yeah. And you're not shy about, telling your readers when you're getting angry, when you're writing the book. So I've noted, like, when reading the book, you say a few times, like, "I'm overwhelmed with anger as I'm writing this sentence," or something like that. Why was that important to you to communicate that?
I don't see how it would be doing anybody a favor to try and remove my narrative from the story. And I think that that's something that's very important to me. And I had a lot of questions about the politics of representation in general about this book. And I feel like this, the work that I do, you know, a lot of it is dealing directly with indigenous societies and is dealing directly with indigenous societies as they're facing agents of colonization, of which I'm a part of. And I don't ever want to take this step of saying, like, I represent this person. In this story, the narrative is coming from me, and I am much more like Woodruff than I am like Arevalo. And that's a hard reality to face, and it makes it a lot more uncomfortable. And it, again, it is the aspects of, you know, my standing in society as a white man and the similarities to Woodruff that can make it a lot more complicated. And I can't run away from that. And I don't want to run away from that. And I don't want to try and present this as history. I mean, as soon as it was done and over with, as soon as we gave it a date and say that Arevalo was killed on April 19th, 2018, for historical look, that's where that story ends. And it doesn't. And that's not even where the story began. It goes way further back. And all these stories just kind of keep going further back. And the way that, you know, to view things in a kind of ethno-historical account and to be an anarchist and to be against civilization, I don't see that being angry is being a problem, or saying that when you're hurting or when you're upset, whether these things are a problem. And if you do the work, and I think I do the work, and I hope that I definitely show that I do the work, you know, I'm not letting that color my perceptions about what it is that's happening. But to try and tell this story, and I've read so much history, and so much of what I read is academic. And I don't understand that approach. I don't feel that does anybody justice. And I'm not saying that as like a cue to be like, oh, here's like, it's not like a laugh track or something like that. It's not like, hey, you should be pissed about this. It's just doing this work and understanding it and feeling the fucking hurt that exists in this world because of civilization and the sheer depravity of meaning that those of us who are supposed to be the benefactors of all this civilization feel is overwhelming. And I mean, there was just no way I was going to be able to write that or write this book or do any of this work without being honest about it. And to me, being honest is the most important thing, because it is a kind of tough path to walk. It is as tough. It is hard to know that you take part in the system and to find accountability for it and to find a way to make that action. Because so many people want to kind of write it off. It's like, well, if you're part of the problem, like if you want to be a hunter-gatherer, just go be a hunter-gatherer. It's like, no, you don't understand. The people who are hunter-gatherers are not allowed to be hunter-gatherers. Right now, the World Wildlife Federation has this entire fortress conservation movement and is going, and they're actually killing hunter-gatherer peoples for being poachers, for being subsistence hunters. Like, the way that we can flatten reality and deny our role within it and is a way of failing to recognize the grasp of the state, of the grasp of civilization, and the grasp of power. And the reality of it is that we believe, even radicals, even people who consider themselves revolutionaries, even people who consider themselves against civilization, we kind of constantly buy into this narrative of freedom that's sold to us, particularly in the first world, and this rugged individualism and rampant egocentric perspective of the world, of thinking, well, if you just want to do that thing, just go do it. What's stopping you? Don't bring me down. And the reality of it is that civilization and colonialism are about decimating and dominating every single aspect of life across the board. That is reality. That's the reality we're all part of. You can't just go off and be the a hunter-gatherer and things are going to be okay. And, you know, is early on when I was coming to terms with a lot of things about being against civilization myself, I felt this need to keep going further and further into the forest. And I found the further I went into the forest, the more the toll and the outside impact were coming in. And that's something you see when you look at the frontier in particular. When you look at colonialism, you just see these waves and things just kind of always tumble. And they're set off this chain reaction that is inescapable. And the fact that even in the Serengeti and the American plains, so many populations of wild animals were wiped out because of fences, because they couldn't keep their migratory paths going solely because of fences. Like, you can't just like jump in and out of this reality and trade where you want, because it feeds into this notion that we have freedom or we have choice. We don't. And that's the problem. And until we attack that system and until we attack that perception of the world, then it's always going to kind of come back to this thing of trying to find some fault with me as a person or with my anger and it being displaced, instead of where is all this coming from? And there is a question in there about what is my relationship to these things. And my relationship in this case is something I want to make clear as a narrator. I wanted this to be Arevalo's story. I want this to be her voice, but she was murdered. And that's the reality we're in.
You made the point that basically there's no outside to civilization and capitalism. And I mean, I agree. And it's interesting how the ayahuasca industry is really built around selling that idea to people that ayahuasca is like the ceremony emerges from an untouched and pristine culture, thousands of years old, and that, you know, I think you make a pretty good argument in your book that ayahuasca ceremony, as it's sold to tourists at least, is a direct result, like in its current form, is a direct result of contact with colonial violence, and not just as an industry, but as a ceremony itself. Can you sort of describe a bit around how ayahuasca came to be this trend, starting with the 1960s and Ginsberg and William Burroughs, and how it's become this kind of big ecotourist industry today?
So in that same Kickstarter thing that you had been reading from, I reference in the book regularly, there's almost a direct quote from Jeremy Narby's book, The Cosmic Serpent. And Jeremy Narby had been influenced by Terence McKenna's Food of the Gods. And in The Cosmic Serpent, he makes this argument that mind-altering substances are at the core of what makes us human. And that's also McKenna's argument. And Terence McKenna's brother, Dennis McKenna, is involved in a kind of like a lot more pharmacology kind of stuff. And, you come back to him and bounce into him and all this different work. But the argument that they present lacks no real historicity and no real historical reality. what they ended up doing was the same kind of colonial adventure that you see all the time, particularly when you're reading about indigenous movements in North America, and particularly about, you know, when you get war historians trying to write biographies of Native American warriors on the plains in the 1800s. You get people jumping into the situation of looking at colonialism and the frontier well underway and assuming that everything that they had seen was untouched. Like, this is how it has been. This is what it is. This is how it has been. And I mean, the reality of it is as we go through in the book and going, you know, in our earlier essay I'd written called Hooked on a Feeling, which is in my book, Gathered Remains, talking about even peyote and, Apene snuffs that were being used in the Amazon, even things like Datura that were being used by Incans and Mayans, because that they had been used at some point. The argument that people like Narby or McKenna take is that this is how it's always been. And so in that essay, Hooked on a Feeling, I go back to peyote, and peyote grows in desert areas, and there's a lot of nomadic cultures that live in those regions. When you pick peyote buds in certain parts of the year, when you pick it in certain rainy seasons and you dry it, the amount of psychoactive substance that is available within it is massively different, massively different. So if you're taking a fresh peyote bud, you're not likely to have any psychoactive effect. You'd have to take a ton of it to have any psychoactive effect. But if you're a nomadic person or somebody like the Tarahumara, who are runners in these regions, and they get most places by long distance running, it's great for snake bites. It's good for endurance. It's good for helping when you have an empty stomach. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why a plant like peyote has an important role in society going back without any pretext for taking it as a hallucinogen. And historically that becomes a part of it. But what ends up happening is, because these plants have a role, we just kind of extrapolate that back. So Narby talking about ayahuasca being 5,000 years old and potentially older in The Cosmic Serpent was taken from McKenna, and McKenna had taken it from an anthropologist who later had to revise his numbers and say 5,000 is wrong. Maybe it's 900 years. And more realistic assessments of it say that ayahuasca use in the Amazon goes back 300 years. And then again, as you were mentioning, as I'll get into, realistically, it's the use that we know now is about 100 years old, and is a direct outpouring in response to the rubber trade. But even in earlier versions where it does pop on, the first places it was found was at these mission stations 300 years ago. So it's like all these people who had seen, and the impacts of colonization can't be overstated. I mean, that's an important part of it. And so, just if I haven't made it clear, that's kind of the underlying context for all this. The people that had been surviving had seen between 50 to 90% of everybody that they'd ever known die as a combination of disease and just execution and murder in the process of colonization. So when you take a bunch of indigenous people from different societies and there's a whole slave trade that is going on and pulling people from different parts of the Amazon, throwing them all together, you know, you're talking about survivors of trauma being grouped with other people that are also considered Indians, but have no necessary relationship between them. And they're all trying to make sense of the reality that they've been tossed into. And in that case, I would say that's a probable beginning for where ayahuasca was mixed with another plant that produces substance that does cause hallucinations. And the role of the shaman comes from a role of the healer, but the healer is meant to help heal wounds in real time, and the shaman's supposed to find a larger kind of cosmological explanation for what's happening. And there's a lot to that. There's a whole lot to that, but it's important to know that, because that's where a lot of these substances come in. And it'll be the person who's a shaman, or in this case, an Onyano, a plant healer, who is supposed to take this heavier substance so they can go to this other place and try and find what's wrong and help heal a person, which is why it's part of a whole cosmological understanding. But the way that these back-to-land hippies and dropout people have picked it up and continue to pick it up is just like they've got some innate truth right there. And instead of being angry about the world, instead of being all these things, let's just find that. Let's just heal. And, you know, that typically takes the form in these ayahuasca retreats. And there's a lot of them in Peru alone right now. When I was checking out the book, I found like 241 retreat centers, and almost all of those are ayahuasca based, but they take just this new age spiritual mishmash of just grabbing and extracting little bits and pieces of every kind of spirituality, every kind of cultural construct from yoga and stuff that's very, very recent, very, very new, and just kind of poaching and appropriating little aspects of everything and trying to throw it into this happy, smiley package of, you know, whatever it is, whatever it becomes, and it becomes this total solution. And it totally denies the reality and the culturally devastating reality of ethnocide and genocide and what it takes for indigenous societies to continue existing, what they have fought for and what they have fought against.
I'm wondering, you said that earlier, that you said that you sought out thinking you're writing a book about cultural appropriation. And I think I understand better what you mean in terms of it didn't turn out to even be about cultural appropriation, because, you know, what is sold as ayahuasca tourism is this sort of manufactured mestizo thing. But I am wondering, what is your take on cultural appropriation generally in terms of, you know, it is a thing that's discussed in the mainstream to some extent, at least in like liberal circles or in university circles, around kind of more basic stuff around racist Halloween costumes or white people with dreadlocks or something like that. But I think what you're pointing out with your book is a much more historic, you know, structural, basically colonialism is the problem. And you know, I think we all know people who feel spiritually empty or culturally empty and are seeking for ways to relate to the land that they lived on, but they're colonizers, they're settler colonizers. So yeah, what do you think about people trying to find ways to, live more authentic lives and make a break with the emptiness that they do feel?
So I do have to correct you real quick. I was surprised at the way that the story went in some ways, but this is still a book about cultural appropriation. I don't seek to say that ayahuasca doesn't become a part of the cultural memory and the cultural traditions of these cultures, just that the version that we know is radically different than the way that it's practiced within those cultures. And if it is a response to colonialism, I'm not going to say that, you know, that makes it less authentic for them.
Right.
I mean, that's a part of the shifting reality of the world that we have impacted and we have enforced upon these people. So it still is about that, but it's just it's more about extraction in a lot of ways. And in that regard, the direct tie is that cultural appropriation is just another form of extractionism. You know, I make a point in the book, and I do understand where Woodruff is coming from in terms of saying, like, he's seen addiction take people in his life and he wanted to try and help them. And I've had the same thing, but the way that we've approached it and the way that he had said that the 12-step programs and interventions that were being used were, it's a dismally low bar. And his idea is, if you toss ayahuasca, or more effectively, if you toss DMT into the mix, it could make that therapeutic process more effective. And that a lot of the arguments for ayahuasca come from that perspective. And the reality of it is that we deny just how meaningless life within civilization has become. So in the immediate period of this book, in the period of Woodruff going down to Peru to learn all these things and then him killing Arevalo and being killed himself, in the United States, the number one killer moves from heart disease to opiate overdose and accidental death and suicide. And the health department and Center for Disease Control are actually saying at this point, accidental deaths, overdoses, and suicides should all just be considered the same thing. It's all a form of passive to active suicide. And it comes down to the fact that we don't have meaning, and we don't have a culture outside of just pride in supposed achievements and often this very colonial massacre oriented approach to the world, individualist approach to the world, where we take pride in things that we just absolutely should not. And it makes sense in a lot of ways why people would say, I just need to find something that has more meaning and makes more sense and has already solved this problem for me, and I'm going to get into it. And that's how the self-help guru and religious infrastructures are billion-dollar industries. And that's how ayahuasca could stand to become a billion-dollar industry, is that it makes a lot more sense to say, I'm just going to go into this thing because this thing's got to figure it out for me. But that's the history of civilization. We're following people who say that they've got to figure it out because we want that thing. And it keeps us from looking around and realizing, you know, the reality of it is never going to be that this makes sense. Civilization is never going to make sense. It's never going to be fulfilling. It never has been. And the consequences and the cost of having civilization and the cost of having technology is detrimental to all life. And as the climate change is barreling ahead, and as peak oil and peak resources are barreling ahead, and these things are turning into pipelines that are causing these massive standoffs with indigenous societies once again, you know, we're coming up against the consequences in a way that we had been able to ignore for what in the long run will appear to be a very historically short period of time that we have in turn idealized and said, well, it's good, so therefore it was worth it. And it wasn't, and it isn't. And the solution is never going to come from poaching other people's cultures and cultures that seem more intact. It comes from understanding what it is that we need as social animals, and understanding, it's one thing to understand how the role that various practices played within more intact societies or ecologically and socially sane societies. And it's another thing to say, well, I'm just going to take pieces of it. It's not your right. That's such a colonial entitled perspective to think like these things have meaning with and of themselves. And you could talk about the Sundance. You could talk about all kinds of native traditions. You could talk about ayahuasca. These things arise as a part of a culture, not as the epitome of a culture. And we have this kind of fantastical look at this and this ridiculous way of saying and looking for answers in this, you know, very therapeutic pro business kind of consumerist identity. We think that we're going to find the answer by just buying something or buying an experience or replicating an experience, and we're going to get some kind of authenticity. And we're going to look at it and say it's different than every other cult out there, and it isn't. The reality of it is that it takes a lot of digging and it takes a lot of work to really understand just how deep the domestication process goes within each of us and just how much we've been subject to this kind of bait and switch of constantly giving ourselves to the system, to giving ourselves to capitalism, giving ourselves to civilization, just to sustain this way of life that is ultimately completely unfulfilling. And the way out for that can't come in anything short of just the destruction of that entire system and the deconstruction of its reality and just demythologizing all the ways in which it has told us that the answer is within. And all these Western therapeutic psychiatric practices that tell us we're all going to be solved or healed on an individual basis.
One thing I do appreciate about the book is, is that it is pretty unsatisfying. Like, there's no easy answers given, and a lot of complicity is revealed through the lineages that you trace in it. You don't come away with it feeling like, okay, I know what to do now. You just have to sit with the discomfort of, everything that it raises. But you did say in the acknowledgments of the book that you are inspired by some of the anti-colonial and decolonial movements that you're aware of. So I'm wondering if you want to talk a bit about the kinds of anti-colonial movements that are inspiring you these days.
So there's a lot. And I'll just focus particularly, you know, if you're in Canada, like, you know, Snowden being one of the big ones. I think the anti-pipeline campaigns are a massive deal. And again, there's aspects of it too, with some of the large NGO kind of groups and white liberal money backed groups that can be involved with some of these things, something like Honor the Earth. There's still issues there and still problems. But I don't want that to ever kind of overshadow what is actually happening, and that all these resistance movements are happening in a way that's really in keeping with the nature of indigenous resistance. And it's got a lot more meaning than I think than any kind of revolutionary history is ever going to have. And that was an important realization for me. Something I struggled with a lot, in the 2000s in particular, is the idea of like revolution and the idea of what's different about indigenous resistance movements that people were willing to fight to the death to maintain or to struggle for their culture versus, you know, the history of revolutionary movements, which typically end in gallows. And, you know, people always say it's like that. Never the end result of the revolution is always the fault of the individuals and not the ideas. But what it comes down to, and I think what lies at the core of this, is when you understand the importance of community, what it means to be a social animal, and you understand what a culture that doesn't have the existential crises that we have as their baseline looks like. So it's not just an identity that has been created and manifested, but an entire cosmology, an entire way of viewing the world and relating to other people, then it stops just being an idea. It stops being an ideology, and it stops being this thing that you hope we're going to get right at some point, and starts being a thing that is real. So when you're looking at these groups and those resistance, and there was things like, you know, talking about water protectors, not protesters, you know, indigenous societies have known these things for a long time, and they've had to fight for them consistently and constantly. And you can see, when you remove yourself from the perspective a little bit, that there are these differences between the way that you can view these things as revolutionaries and the way you see it as like communal resistance. And so when you look at something like the Unistoten camps, you know, they weren't just out there to say, we're going to have this symbolic blockade. And we're talking about, we're going to build a cultural center to block a pipeline. And we're going to revitalize our community and our traditions through this act of resistance. We're reclaiming this culture as we are reclaiming grounds. And in a lot of cases, reclaiming grounds that were taken illegally because they're unceded lands. And there's just so much to that, that it's amazing. And I don't want to make it seem like it's just this purely romantic thing. And you can talk about stuff like indigenous societies when they kill missionaries, or they kill loggers, or they kill prospectors when they're coming into areas where voluntarily isolated or uncontacted societies exist. So you look at something like the killing of the U.S. missionary John Chow recently by the Sentinelese, who are nomadic hunter-gatherers that live on, or hunter-gatherers that live on North Sentinel Island in the Andaman Islands. You know, that made the news, and I think that's good. And I think there's a lot to be said about missionaries, and a lot that I have been saying and will continue to say about missionaries. But there's a part of me that wants to be like excited about that. Like, yeah, they killed a missionary, he deserved it. But the reality of it is that his decaying body on the beach is a pathogen, and nobody really gets joy from killing. These people never wanted to be put in a position where they had to defend themselves by killing anybody who comes into it. And it's a longstanding tradition. And by all means, everybody knows if you're going to the Sentinel Islands, that's most likely going to be the outcome. But we keep doing it anyways. And so it's like, there's that line you got to watch between understanding decolonization movements, and in cases such as the, you know, the killing of a missionary, and anti-colonialism, of not just like romanticizing the violence of it. The reality of it is that this, what we have attained with civilization, what is occurring because of civilization, is something that should have never gotten this far. And it's as much promise as you can see in the fact that there is still fight out there and there still is struggle out there. I can 100% guarantee you there's nobody coming from the Unistoten camp saying, I'm glad we're in this position. Like, it should have just never happened. This shouldn't be a fight that they have to have. This shouldn't have to be the reason for revitalization movements. It just shouldn't have happened. And the reality of it is, until civilization collapses, until it is brought down, until it ends, these are the realities of the world that we have created and that we face. And there is no safety in it. And I don't have solutions for it, other than saying we cannot ignore what is going on here. And we also cannot just sit by and watch as it happens. And that's why it is so important to look at decolonization movements, to look at anti-colonial persistence, and understand these things are out here, and that there's so many other parts of the world and so many other places and peoples within this world that don't just get lost in an existential crisis of wanting to be right about things. And they're having to take matters into their own hands and finding a way to ask ourselves, why don't we feel that way too? And why aren't we acting in kind? And how long do we just go along buying into this and hoping that something like ayahuasca is going to make sense of it all magically, instead of actively taking part in this resistance ourselves, and to build relationships with other people and to build relationships with the land that aren't based off of predatory practices or predatory approaches to the world.
All we've got time for tonight on From Embers. If you want to find the book we've been talking about or any of Kevin Tucker's other writings, you can check out kevintucker.org or blackandgreenreview.org. You can also find Kevin's own podcast at primalanarchy.org. As always, if you liked what you heard tonight and want to hear more, you can tune in here on CFRC 101.9 FM every Wednesday night from 8 to 9 p.m., or you can subscribe and download the podcast version of From Embers on your phone or other device. If you've got feedback, if you want to talk about it, if you'd like to suggest a show idea for From Embers, you can reach out to us at fromembers@riseup.net. Thanks for listening.
Soulcast is a twice-a-month anarchist podcast hosted by North American rap artist Soul. It's a podcast about revolutionary politics from an anarchist perspective. Every month, I interview academics, journalists, revolutionaries, quote-unquote activists, artists, musicians, and really anything that I find interesting. I never got to go to college, so this, I guess, is my cheat sheet. So anybody who wants to learn, you can learn with me. Subscribe in iTunes at tinyurl.com/soulcast and check it out on the Channel Zero Podcast Network. We are